This is the October edition of Muse, the magazine of life, the universe, and pie throwing. I'm Chris, radio volunteer Carla Pariser. I'm going to skip the letters of the month and go right to Muse news, beginning on page 6. Light sleepers. Chinstrap penguins take more than 10,000 naps a day. When a chinstrap penguin couple is waiting for their eggs to hatch, one parent goes out to search for food at sea, while the other stays behind to protect their eggs. While studying the parents left behind, researchers made a stunning discovery. Chinstrap penguins take more than 10,000 micronaps, or very brief naps, each day. These naps often last mere seconds, an average of 4 seconds, yet they add up to more than 11 hours of sleep per day. For the study, researchers from France, Germany, and South Korea studied 14 chinstrap penguin parents on King George Island in Antarctica. They used remote electroencephalogram, EEG monitoring, and other non-invasive brain sensors. They also observed the penguins in person and using video. This work required much more counting than was expected. The penguins took more than 600 micronaps an hour. In all, about 75% of their sleep lasted less than 10 seconds. The researchers and other scientists think these very brief periods of sleep allow the chinstrap penguins to stay aware of their surroundings. But it appears it's not just about keeping an eye out for possible predators. Those penguins in the noisy center of a penguin colony had even shorter naps than those nesting at the border of the colony. Page 7. A zombie-like tropical fern uses its dead leaves to stay alive. Typically, when the leaves or fronds of most plants have died, the plants have no further use for them. Such is not the case with Cyathea rohazania, a fern growing in Panama. In a surprising new discovery, researchers found these plants use their dead fronds to gather nutrients from the soil. While studying a different type of plant in Panama, researchers noticed something strange happening with the dead fronds of Cyathea rohazania. Drooping to the ground, they had grown tiny roots. It turns out these roots help reverse the way water flows through the plants, allowing them to gather nitrogen, a crucial compound for plant life, from the soil. Cyathea rohazania ferns usually grow slowly, and the nutrients in the soil in Panama are often unevenly distributed. By using their dead fronds to extend their reach rather than growing larger roots, the plants waste less time and energy to get the nutrients they need to survive. The Rubik's Cube turns 50. The year 2024 marks the 50th anniversary of the invention of the wildly popular multicolored puzzle Rubik's Cube. Erno Rubik, a Hungarian architecture professor and sculptor, was looking for a way to teach his college students in Budapest about 3D, three-dimensional objects. His goal was to create a mechanism with moving parts that could move independently without the object falling apart. It took him a while to realize he'd created a puzzle. The Magic Cube, as it was first called, was patented in 1975 and released in toy shops in Budapest in 1977. In 1980, it was renamed Rubik's Cube and was named Game of the Year in Germany. Soon, Cube Mania swept much of the world, including the United States, as the original 3x3x3 model became hugely popular for its clean design and mathematical underpinnings. The original Rubik's Cube, still the most popular version, has 6 different colors and 54 squares, 9 on each face. A solved cube has each of its faces the same color. For such a simple mechanism, the Rubik's Cube has enormous complexity. There are some 43, 223, 003, 274, 489, 856, 000, or 43 quintillion possible square combinations. If it takes you a while to solve, you are not alone. Some people, though, are whizzes at it and compete in international competitions. The current world record for the fastest solve of the 3x3x3 model was set in July 2023 by American Max Park. His time, 3.13 seconds. Page 8. New giant horned dinosaur species discovered. In 2019, in the badlands of northern Montana, a dinosaur fossil was unearthed. In June 2024, researchers announced that the animal was a species of dinosaur never before found, a cousin of Triceratops. They called it Lociceratops rangiformis. The name translates to Loki's horned face that looks like a caribou. Lociceratops is a member of the horned dinosaurs known as ceratopsids. Its horns are the largest and most ornate in this family. At first, researchers assumed it was one of the four known species of ceratopsids. But as they pieced the skull together, they realized it was a new species entirely. The researchers say Lociceratops lived 78 million years ago alongside four other known dinosaur species. Three of the species were closely related. The scientists say this shows more diversity in these and likely other dinosaur species than previously understood. They likened the dinosaur horns to bird feathers in helping the animals stand out and impress one another. Tomatoes tempt vampire bats. Farmers in the South American country of Argentina have a new trick up their sleeves to keep vampire bats away from their cattle, feeding them baked tomatoes. Vampire bats come out at night in search of the blood of warm mammals, often cows. It's their primary food source. These small flying mammals, which can be friendly to humans, don't suck the blood the way Dracula does. Instead, they make a tiny bite using their sharp teeth in the victim's skin, then drink up the blood that drips out. They're so efficient at it, they can sometimes drink the blood of an animal for 30 minutes without waking them up. To lure bats away from their cattle, some farmers tried cooking tomatoes to use as decoys. They bake the tomatoes in an oven to make them warm and juicy before placing them outside. The heat is thought to help lure the bats, as they have heat sensors on their noses that help them locate available blood. Bats have been finding the warm red fruit, biting into the tomato skin, and lapping up the juice. This new technique has helped the farmers protect their cattle from blood loss as well as diseases that vampire bats can spread, such as rabies. Whether it will help curtail vampire bats' thirst for mammal blood entirely is another story. Page 9. Students build sun-powered off-road car. College students in the Netherlands have successfully built an off-road vehicle that's completely powered by the sun. It's a two-seater with solar panels on its roof. They named it Stellaterra. To test it, they drove it more than 1,000 kilometers, 621 miles, from the north of Morocco through different landscapes to the Sahara Desert in northern Africa. Except for some minor adjustments along the way, the car performed even better than the students had hoped. Among other things, they had built their own converter for turning the sunlight from the solar panels into electricity to power the car. The vehicle was highly efficient, burning 30% less energy than expected. Experts point out that it's not easy building a car that's energy efficient and able to handle rough conditions. That the students managed to do both could inspire car makers to build cars that need neither gas nor charging stations. One supporter says that solar-powered cars could even one day help provide electricity to homes. Page 11. Mammoth return? The steep path to de-extinction. A strong wind howls over a snowy plain. A herd of large, shaggy animals grazes on tall grasses and dwarf plants. They look like elephants in winter coats. This peaceful, true-to-life scene could have been found during the last ice age in the northern regions of Asia, Eastern Europe, or North America. The animals, known as woolly mammoths, were closely related to elephants. They exhibited similar traits and behaviors, but were better adapted for a cold climate. Mammoths possessed such features as extra fat to keep warm, large feet to walk on snow, and long curled tusks to crack ice in search of plants to eat. The woolly mammoth's extinction. Alas, like many other species of large mammals alive during this period, the saber-toothed cat, the mastodon, the mammoth did not survive. The species went extinct. Recent research shows that the driving force behind their demise was likely a warming climate. As temperatures climbed, the patches of vegetation that they relied on in the Arctic tundra disappeared. The last living mammoth is believed to have taken its final breath about 3,700 years ago on Wrangel Island. This island was once part of territory that linked what are now Alaska and Russia, called Beringia. Or was it the animal's final breath? Startlingly, scientists today think they have figured out how to create new mammoths, or at least mammoth-like animals, using recent scientific discoveries and technological advances. Bringing extinct animals such as mammoths back to life, known as de-extinction, will be a long and difficult process, however. Challenges loom at nearly every step. And de-extinction expert Beth Shapiro says, if mammoth-like animals are eventually created, they will really be elephants whose genes have been tweaked to make them look and act like mammoths. Not everyone agrees that scientists should bring an extinct animal species back from the dead, even if they could. Some feel such a decision is not for people to make. Others, including some scientists, think such large, gentle, intelligent creatures could help revitalize ecosystems or biological communities and fight climate change. Some people, including Shapiro, say that the technologies that are developed to make such work possible will likely help with conservation efforts. We are in a crisis of extinction and a crisis of arable land, she says, and we need to be able to figure out how we're going to push ourselves toward a future Earth that is both biodiverse and filled with people. De-extinction and the mammoth. When did the idea of de-extinction become more than wishful thinking? It started when scientists made a discovery in the 1980s. DNA can stay intact in organisms for long periods after death. DNA, the biological blueprints for living things, is key to making de-extinction possible. Found in cells, DNA contains genes that determine the traits of animals and plants. If DNA can be removed from old fossils, then perhaps scientists supposed it could be grown and developed into new animals. DNA begins to break down immediately after death, Shapiro says. But because mammoths lived in chilly areas like the Arctic, their DNA can remain behind an especially long time, more than a million years, we now know. That's because, like food in a freezer, DNA is partly protected by the cold. The mammoth might make a good de-extinction candidate for other reasons as well. Like the elephant, the mammoth was not only a herbivore or plant eater, but a keystone species, one that other animals and plants depend on for their survival. Finding fossils with useful DNA. Finding fossils that contain enough useful mammoth DNA is the first challenge in creating a new mammoth creature, Shapiro explains in her book, How to Clone a Mammoth. In the past few decades, Earth's climate has heated up and many glaciers have melted. These changes have helped people to find a number of mammoth fossils. In 2007, in northern Russia, a complete carcass of a young mammoth was discovered, still covered in wool and with her internal organs intact. Scientists call her Lyuba. Yet, even if a mammoth specimen is well preserved, the DNA found with it doesn't necessarily belong solely to the mammoth. Microbes, including bacteria and other tiny organisms, likely have taken up residence over time, and humans and animals may have touched the remains, leaving their own DNA behind. What's more, Shapiro says, keeping museum samples and others at room temperature speeds the breakdown of their genuine DNA. Shapiro travels regularly from the United States to Canada's Yukon Territory and other northern territories in search of well-preserved ancient DNA. Besides discovering some large mammoth bones, she and her team once unearthed two horse bones that turned out to be 700,000 years old. For several years, these were the oldest fossils found with DNA still intact. Completing mammoth DNA. In 2010, scientist Craig Venter and his team created a simple life form using other ones in a lab. They copied a complete set of genes, called a genome, from a tiny bacterium, a single-celled microorganism. Then they introduced this genome into another bacterium whose genome had been removed. Amazingly, this cell survived and multiplied. Shapiro and de-extinction scientist George Church of Harvard University in Massachusetts believe a similar process could be used to create a large animal. The challenge with mammoths lies in collecting enough genes to copy, as a whole genome of a mammoth isn't available today. Shapiro and Church, though, see a way to bridge this genetic gap. Mammoths share about 99.6% of their genes with the living Asian elephant, so the Asian elephant's genes could be combined with the mammoth's to create a new hybrid version of mammoth. In 2015, Church and his team succeeded in using a powerful new gene editing tool called CRISPR, pronounced CRISPR, to copy mammoth genes into an elephant's genome. These included some of the genes responsible for traits like thick hair, extra fat, small ears, and rich oxygenated blood needed for cold environments. In March 2024, a new company that Shapiro and Church helped lead announced that they had, for the first time, developed stem cells from elephant cells. Such cells can be made to grow into any type of elephant cell. These cells will allow the scientists to test the tweaks needed for an Asian elephant's genome to become more like a woolly mammoth's. They could also be used to help elephants reproduce. From cell to animal. Cloning is the process of copying a cell or life form. Scientists first cloned a mammal, a baby sheep named Dolly, in 1996. They have since achieved the same feat with other animals, including mice, cats, dogs, and horses. Cloning takes place in a lab. It is often accomplished through the transfer of the part of a cell that contains the DNA, called the nucleus, from the cell of one adult animal to an egg cell that has been removed from a female of the same species. If the new cell survives, it multiplies and grows into an embryo, an animal or plant in its earliest stage. This embryo is usually implanted into the womb of a third animal that, if all goes well, eventually gives birth to a baby animal. This newborn is a clone, or duplicate, of the original animal that provided the nucleus, as the two share the same genes. Mammoths can't be cloned today, Shapiro explains, because cloning requires a living cell. But cloning techniques can be applied once a living elephant cell's genome is edited to include mammoth traits. The cell's nucleus would be transferred to the egg cell of a female elephant. This new cell might multiply and grow into an embryo, which could then be placed inside a mother elephant, or possibly an artificial womb, to develop. Later, a baby mammoth-like animal might indeed be born, but it would be the only one of its kind. To establish this version of mammoth as a species, more such animals would need to be created. To be healthy, the species would need to be made up of individuals that are different, not just clones. So scientists would have to repeat the whole process of getting DNA, completing it, and growing and editing new cells. A suitable place to live. The mammoth-like animals would need a suitable home to live, grow, and reproduce. Elephants, Shapiro points out, do better in the wild, where they can roam freely and interact with others than they do in captivity, where these activities are limited. Through analysis of tusks, the same has recently been found to be true for mammoths. In 1988, Russian scientist Sergei Zimov established Pleistone Park, a large nature reserve in Siberia, where mammoths and grasslands once thrived. Over the years, he has introduced into his parkland many large herbivore mammal species, including bison, musk oxen, moose, horses, and reindeer. Most of these animals have done well there. Mammoth-like creatures, Zimov believes, could help restore this area to its long-ago vibrancy and help halt the warming of the planet. With their lumbering and grazing, mammoths transported nutrients and naturally tilled the earth. These actions supported healthy grasslands, which in turn protected the permafrost, or frozen soil, underneath the surface. Pleistocene Park was never envisioned as a tourist attraction like the fictional Jurassic Park, but as a way to help turn the tables on climate change. Scientists have laid a clear path for creating new mammoth-like creatures, but technical hurdles and thorny ethical questions remain. Because elephants are currently endangered, some people don't believe female elephants should be used to help create different animals. Others argue that methods developed for de-extinction could be key to protecting elephants and other endangered animals from going extinct. What do you think? Is trying to bring mammoth-like animals back to life a worthy scientific goal? Page 16. Beth Shapiro, Chief Science Officer, Colossal. In March, Beth Shapiro left her job researching and teaching molecular ecology and ancient DNA at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She joined Colossal, a new company working to de-extinct animals like the woolly mammoth and to develop technologies and methods to help protect living species from going extinct. Though she had worked as a scientific consultant to the company for a couple of years, the move surprised even her, she says. In talks, articles, and books, and her interview with us back in April 2018, which follows, she has shared how the process of de-extinction could work, but she also has often underscored how difficult creating mammoth-like animals would be, and that the animals would never be 100% mammoth. Today, she sees new technologies for de-extinction as crucial to saving other animals from going extinct. Let's develop these technologies, because we don't have any more time, she says now. We are in a crisis of extinction, and we are in a crisis of arable land. We need to be able to figure out how we are going to push ourselves toward a future Earth that is both biodiverse and filled with people, and we need to not reject technologies just because we're scared of them. What drew you to studying ancient DNA? I did a summer science field program after my freshman year of college, in which we drove across the country for 9 weeks, sleeping in national parks and learning about the geological and anthropological history of the U.S. This experience exposed me to all of these living things that used to be here but weren't anymore, and I found that to be intriguing. Why are so many things not here anymore? And why have things that are still here survived when other things went extinct? And one way to spin that is to look at the shapes and colors and patterns that we see in fossils. But this new tool, ancient DNA, makes it possible to dig even deeper into those questions. For example, in the Yukon, where I work in northern Canada, we have horse bones that we know span the last 700,000 years. By looking at the fossils, we say, oh look, horses were present in North America for at least the last 700,000 years. But with the DNA, we see more things like, oh, 50,000 years ago, there was an enormous migration event where horses came across the Barren Land Bridge and joined populations that were already here. Looking at DNA using new technologies can reveal patterns and processes of evolution that were previously invisible. What are your views about de-extinction? I think that if the goal is to bring back a mammoth so you could say, I brought back a mammoth and put it in a zoo so we can stare at it and say, oh look, there's a mammoth, then I'm not sure that's a very ethical thing to do. In my mind, if we're going to go through the trouble of resurrecting things, then we should really have ironed out why we're going to do it. One other question is, do we know why it went extinct? And if we do, have we solved the problem that caused it to go extinct in the first place? Whether it's the mammoth or the passenger pigeon or the dodo or some other extinct species, there's a different suite of technical, ethical, and ecological challenges that would be associated with bringing them back to life. Some of these challenges are not solved. Some of them are in the process of being solved. And some of them are really hard to solve. And it depends. It varies by species. How does de-extinction fit into the genetic rescue of currently endangered animals? Genetic rescue of endangered animals use the same technologies we think about applying in de-extinction, but it is easier to achieve. For example, the endangered black-footed ferrets are highly susceptible to a disease called Selvatic plague. Their genes could be edited for greater diversity using cells from earlier, stronger black-footed ferrets that have been preserved. Or we might be able to give them genes for immunity from domestic ferrets that have a natural immunity to the plague. Such genetic editing could protect newly born black-footed ferrets from this deadly disease throughout their lives. What research projects are you and your team working on? We're working on sequencing the genome of the dodo, which is an involved process. We're also looking a lot at a period of rapid environmental change that happens around 11,700 years ago, which was the transition into the current warm period. One of the things we're trying to learn using DNA isolated from the remains of animals is how populations and communities and even entire ecosystems responded in this global warming event. So we're using the past as a completed evolutionary experiment from which we can hopefully learn something that's useful to protect species and ecosystems in the present. I'm going to skip Life on Earth, an Approximate Timeline, as well as Hands-On, Great Caesar's Ghost, and Art Space, Discover the Astonishing True Story of the Victorian Ghost Hunters. So let's move on to Seriously Spooky Seances, page 27. Knock, crack, thud. From the outside, it looked like an innocent house. A front door, a window on each side, and a couple more windows under the point of the roof. Inside, though, strange things were happening. It was March 1848. All month, eerie noises had been startling the family that lived in this home in Hydesville, New York. The noises particularly seemed to follow the daughters, Kate, 11 years old, and Maggie, 14. The family couldn't find an explanation. Not mice, not bats, not the wood of the house settling into place. It seemed that someone, something, from somewhere else, was trying to get in touch. At least that's what the girl's mother, Margaret Fox, believed. On the night of March 31st, Mrs. Fox announced they would attempt to contact whatever the thing was. In the family's candlelit bedroom, she called out to the supernatural being, "Count to 5, count to 15. Did the strange being answer? It did. It knocked the correct number of times. And who was it? Margaret continued to ask questions. The being knocked in response. The family determined it was the spirit of a salesman who used to travel from house to house. And why was he bothering the Fox family? Because he had been murdered, and his bones were buried in their basement. A creepy craze. People around the world have tried to contact the dead for thousands of years. Did the Fox sisters actually manage to do it? Many were certain they had. Word of the girl's success spread. They were soon contacting spirits for others who desperately wanted to speak to dead loved ones. They put on performances for crowds in packed theaters. They went across the Atlantic Ocean and toured their skills around Great Britain. Lots of others claimed to have the same talents. They became known as mediums, people who say they can speak to the dead. The idea of speaking to the dead became so popular, a new religion formed called spiritualism. Millions of people believed. On the bottom of page 28, sneaky mediums and twitchy muscles. That's good. The table's lifting up now. That's good. It was 1996, and a medium was conducting a seance. He was trying to convince participants that the table was moving beneath their hands. Except he wasn't a real medium. He was an actor, and this wasn't a typical seance. It was an experiment put on by researchers in the United Kingdom, and the table wasn't moving. 2 weeks later, the researchers asked the participants if the table had moved. More than 30% said it had. Why? The medium had suggested it, so that's what they remembered. Combine suggestions like this with creepy rooms, helpers hidden in the dark, and a desperate desire to contact dead loved ones, and it's easy to see how seance participants could be fooled. After all, the mediums called themselves experts. But sometimes we can't blame other people. Sometimes we simply fool ourselves. Take the Ouija board, pronounced Ouija. Back in the Fox sisters' day, mediums often communicated with spirits through a series of knocks, but talking in this way could take a long, boring time. In the 1890s, the Kennard Novelty Company from Baltimore, Maryland, presented a solution. Use its new Ouija board, and the spirit could communicate right away. These boards are still found in toy and game shops today. They display the alphabet, numbers 0 to 9, and the words yes, no, and goodbye. All participants place their fingertips on a pointing device called a planchette. Ask a question, and the spirit will slide the planchette around the board to spell out the answer. Many people using these boards have freaked themselves out. They didn't push the planchette. Their friends swear they didn't push the planchette. And if no one in the room pushed the planchette, it must have been a spirit. Again, science has proven them wrong. As far back as 1852, scientists have known that human muscles can move without telling our brains. So if we think, without realizing it, that a spirit will answer yes to a question, our muscles will slide the planchette to that word on the Ouija board, even if we're absolutely 100% sure we didn't do it. If mediums lie and our own bodies lie, does this mean spirits don't exist? Not necessarily, but they had better find more reliable ways to get their messages across. Now back to the article, page 28, hold my hand tightly. There were many ways to talk to the dead, but one of the most common was through a seance. The curtains were shut, the lights were kept low, participants sat around a small table holding hands. The medium called to the spirits, and then all sorts of bizarre things could happen. The table might turn or tip over. Items placed on the table, a bell or a watch, might float. Other objects, fruit or flowers, might appear out of nowhere. Writing from the spirit might magically appear on a small chalkboard slate. The medium's voice might change. It wasn't her talking. It was the spirit. Ghosts might glow in the corner of the room. It was terrifying, thrilling, astonishing. Mysterious music. Ira and William Davenport were brothers from Buffalo, New York. They began their careers as mediums in 1854 and became big hits. Their top attraction was a cabinet filled with musical instruments. They said it connected them to the spirit world. The brothers sat inside the cabinet, and volunteers tied them up and closed the doors. Then the musical instruments played. When the doors opened, the brothers remained tied up. The music makers must have been spirits. One witness, author Arthur Conan Doyle, declared the Davenport brothers probably the greatest mediums of their kind the world has ever seen. Today, we know Conan Doyle as the creator of Detective Sherlock Holmes. He believed in spiritualism and contacting the dead. He regularly sought advice from spirits, like which train he should take. His wife, Jean, was a medium. At his funeral in July 1930, another medium said she saw Conan Doyle's spirit there in the room. Ghosts visit the White House. Sherlock's creator wasn't the only famous person who held seances. Jane Pierce was the wife of U.S. President Franklin Pierce, 1804 to 1869. After her son died in a train accident in January 1853, she invited the Fox sisters to the White House. Pierce called the seance a success. She was later relieved to visit with her son and with another son who had died earlier in her dreams. Mary Todd Lincoln was the wife of President Abraham Lincoln. They had also lost two sons, Eddie and Willie. Mary Lincoln held many seances at the White House in hopes of speaking to them. She too was thrilled when they appeared as ghosts in her bedroom. After her husband was assassinated in 1865, she had a photo taken of herself, but not alone. The picture showed the former president's bright ghost standing behind her, hands on her shoulders. Another murder revealed. One famous series of seances occurred on Cock Lane in London, England. In the late 1750s, a woman named Elizabeth Kent had died in childbirth. Her husband, William, then fell in love with her sister, Fanny. William and Fanny moved into a home on Cock Lane with owner Richard Parsons and his family. But William and Richard didn't get along. Soon, William and Fanny moved out. Even before this, residents in the house had heard unexplained knockings and scratchings. Next, the Parsons family saw a ghost. Was it Elizabeth, angry that her sister and husband were together? People thought so. Shortly after, Fanny caught smallpox and died. But the noises continued. Richard Parsons' 12-year-old daughter, also named Elizabeth, had strange fits. The spirit was restless. A series of seances supposedly figured out the mystery. The spirit wasn't William's deceased wife after all. Rather, it was Fanny. And she said she didn't die from smallpox. She had been poisoned by William himself. In the end, though, William didn't go to jail. Richard did, for he had made it all up. There was no spirit. William hadn't murdered Fanny. Instead, young Elizabeth had made the sounds by using a hidden piece of wood. Richard had been angry with William and wanted revenge. Real or make-believe? Were all contacts with spirits tricks? After many years of shocking audiences with their musical cabinet, the Davenport brothers confessed they were really good at untying knots. They themselves played the instruments. Before he died, Abraham Lincoln discovered that one of Mary's mediums had a noisemaker strapped to his arm. In Germany, in 1902, detectives found apples, oranges, and flowers in the folds of a medium's petticoat. These items would appear out of nowhere during her seances. In 1884, a group from the University of Pennsylvania investigated many mediums. They didn't find scientific evidence of contact with the dead, but they did discover lots of tricks. For example, to produce messages on a slate, the medium might secretly write under the table, or she might switch a blank slate with a hidden pre-written one. Even famous magician Harry Houdini didn't have faith. He said he knew too much about deceiving people to be deceived himself. He promised that, if possible, he would get in touch with his wife Bess after his own death. Several years after he died, with no word, Bess gave up. Ha ha, fooled you. After a successful 40-year career, even the Fox sisters confessed. In 1888, they admitted they had faked everything. All that spooky knocking? In their childhood home, they had thumped apples across the floor. Then they had learned to loudly crack their toes, knuckles, and other joints. One day, bones were found in their old home's basement. Was it the murdered salesman? No, the bones were a trick, too. It was not a complete skeleton. Some of the bones came from chickens. And that time they had contacted their first spirit, no one, except maybe the girls, seemed to have noticed the night slipping into the next day. That day was April Fool's. Question and answer. Question. Why are the skins of witches in kids' stories supposedly green? Why not pink or yellow? Sam A., age 11, Oregon. Answer. The first witch shown with vibrant green skin is also the most famous to date, the Wicked Witch of the West from The Wizard of Oz. The 1939 movie, that is. In L. Frank Baum's novel, her skin isn't any special color, but the filmmakers added color to a lot of things that didn't pop as brightly in the original story. Dorothy's silver shoes became ruby slippers. Horses in the Emerald City gained the ability to change color on a whim. And of course, the Wicked Witch took on her green hue, all the better to highlight the difference between drab, black and white Kansas and fantastical Oz. filmed with a new technology allowing a rainbow of colors. Still, the filmmakers could have chosen any color for the witch's skin. She could have been blue or purple or even hot pink. Why green? That's what I asked Deanna Petheridge, an artist and writer who has studied witches. She put together a museum exhibit called Witches and Wicked Bodies at the British Museum in London. The association of witches with greenness is very ancient, she told me. It goes back at least to ancient Rome. The poet Ovid described invidia, the embodiment of envy, as having some pale, greenish features and poison dripping from her mouth. Many of invidia's characteristics, including her connection to the color green, later became part of European and American representations of the witch as a hideous old hag. In this context, a green tint also reminds us of dead bodies, says Laura Stokes. She's a historian at Stanford University in California, studying how women accused of witchcraft were treated in the Middle Ages. When a dead body starts to decompose, its skin takes on a greenish tinge. Think of Frankenstein's monster, she says, who stays green even after he's brought back to life. What better color to be associated with a scary, deadly, unnatural witch? But there's another side to the witch, and to the color green, Petheridge says. Sure, some witches are depicted as ugly and frightening, but others are stunningly beautiful. Beauty makes us think of fertility, which reminds us of nature and brings us back to green. Petheridge calls this link to both life and death the double stereotype of the witch. Eventually, as the witch became confined mostly to children's stories, her opposite sides were split into two characters, the good witch and the bad witch, famously seen in The Wizard of Oz. This same dynamic will be key in the upcoming movie Wicked. Science at Work, page 32. Jessica Metcalf. Jessica Metcalf likes solving different kinds of puzzles. Her research projects involve varied fields, including animal science, health, and forensics, the scientific analysis of criminal physical evidence. From her lab at Colorado State University, she studies microorganisms found in the gastrointestinal tracts of humans and non-human animals and what they reveal about the individual's health. She uses decomposing microbial ecology to predict meat shelf life and spoilage, and she uses DNA sequencing to identify and study the microbes that decompose human bodies. DNA sequencing is a technique that allows scientists to read the DNA of an organism. Many organisms can be identified just by examining a small section of their DNA called a gene. By sequencing a specific gene in the DNA of microbe samples, she collects at different stages of decomposition, Metcalf knows which tiny organisms are present and when they appear. She's using this information to develop a microbial clock that can tell crime investigators how long a person has been dead. Did you always want to be a scientist? I didn't really have any idea what I was going to do when I was growing up. When I entered college and met with my advisor, I said everything from an artist to a medical physician or possibly a teacher. So at first, I took a bunch of different classes. By the end of my freshman year, I had really taken an interest in the scientific classes and had started working in a chemistry lab. So that's kind of when I started my scientific career. What is the necrobiome? The necrobiome is usually described as the community of microbes decaying an animal. It includes many different types of bacteria, fungi, nematodes, microscopic worms. Some of the bacteria make really stinky byproducts called cadaverine and putrescine. Why is it important to study microbes? Because microbes are everywhere, and because people carry them around and leave them places, and because they're part of many fundamental processes on Earth, they're actually a potentially important form of physical evidence. They are currently underused in forensic science, though. My research focuses on trying to develop ways that we can use microbes in forensic science. How does a microbial clock work? We know microbes are really important in decomposition. One of our big questions has been whether the groups of microbes that are involved in decomposition change over time. If so, is that progression over time always the same, regardless of whether you die in Tennessee or in Texas or in Colorado? We have found that the succession of microbes is pretty similar regardless of where you are. Decomposition is such an important earth process that evolution has worked out who does what and when. Different microorganisms become abundant at certain time points because certain nutrients are available, and that means we are able to turn that into a microbial clock. For example, if a body were discovered, we might examine the skin and find more than 1,000 different types of microbes. We could look on our clock and ask, where do we find these microbes on our clock? We might find them between 7 and 9 days, and then we can estimate the time of death for this person to be 7 to 9 days. We use computers and math to do this very quickly. How do you study microbes on human remains? We have the opportunity to study decomposition because some people decide they want to donate their bodies to medical science. And one area you can donate to specifically is forensic science research. There are about 7 of these anthropologic research facilities at universities around the country that accept human donors. After donors pass away, their bodies become part of a forensic science research project. I work with 3 of those facilities. To study the microbes, we take swabs, small samples, of the soil near a body and swabs of the skin of the body every day for 21 days. We sequence the genes in those samples, and from that, we're able to say what microbes were in that sample. This is how we build the microbial clock. When we're out there, we're always wearing protective gear. There shouldn't be anything harmful about these bodies, but it's to protect us, and it's also to protect the bodies from being contaminated by us. What about the smell? Working with decomposing bodies is indeed a very smelly business. I don't do most of the sample collection for the human studies because they're done at an anthropological research station, but it's definitely smelly, and I'm very thankful for the student workforce that does the bulk of the collection work. Do you think studying the necrobiome is creepy? I would not want to be collecting samples at one of the forensic research facilities at midnight on Halloween, that's for sure. When you aren't teaching or researching, what do you like to do? I have a very cute dog who is my hiking partner here in Colorado. I also do a lot of science outreach through an organization I helped found called 500 Women Scientists. Our mission is to make science open, inclusive, and accessible and interesting to other people, and to help people imagine a diversity of different types of people who could be scientists. You can check us out at 500womenscientists.org. On page 35 in the red, A Second Life at a Body Farm. When someone finds a body, crime investigators comb the site for clues. Who is this person? How did they die? Was it an accident? Murder? Did it happen here? Or was the body dumped? How long ago? A body farm, more properly known as a forensic anthropology research facility, is a safe, secure place where researchers study human remains. Here, scientists can observe bodies decomposing in a hot, dry field or in a forest in winter or in any other weather and compare the differences. Develop new tools to estimate a person's time of death and look for new ways to identify that person. Recreate crime scenes to help law enforcement see what might have happened. The bodies donated to these research facilities live an incredible second life, offering researchers valuable knowledge and helping law enforcement solve crimes. They tell the story of what might have happened to an unidentified body. Page 36, do the math. Bury thirsty. Mathematicians help farmers facing drought conditions figure out what crops to grow. A visit to a supermarket offers you choices from a wide range of produce, not only vegetables of all sorts, but also berries and other fruit. You can decide whether to go for strawberries, delicious with ice cream, or apples, great in pie, or just for munching. It's not so easy for farmers. They have to decide what to grow while worrying about getting their crops enough water and wondering if they'll make money or even break even. Many aspects of farming are difficult, says mathematician Estelle Bazor. She's deputy director of the American Institute of Mathematics in Palo Alto in Northern California. Farmers face a lot of unknowns, including weather, pests, and an idea in economics called supply and demand. Farmers may, for example, grow more strawberries than their customers are ready to buy or demand. So to get rid of the supply, they end up selling their strawberries at lower prices. If prices fall too low, farmers don't make enough to cover the cost of growing the crop. Baeser grew up in Watsonville, California, in the heart of the Pajaro Valley, one of the richest agricultural areas in the world. She was one of several mathematicians who worked together to come up with methods to help farmers make decisions about what to grow and especially how to reduce water use. Farms in California, including those in the Pajaro Valley, produce about 80% of the fresh strawberries you can buy in American supermarkets. In most recent years, however, California has suffered a drought. The Pajaro Valley and other areas of the state are feeling the effects of the shortage of rainfall. Pajaro Valley farmers draw their water from an underground reservoir, or aquifer. The trouble is that they have been pumping water out of the aquifer faster than it can be replaced by rainfall, and the drought has made things even worse. Many farmers are interested in whether it would be worthwhile to switch to crops that use less water, but that people will still buy. The mathematician started by collecting information on water use, crop prices, and other variables. They then programmed computers to, in effect, play a game. The goal was to find the combination of crops that would produce the highest profit using the least amount of water, all while meeting customer demand. This approach is an example of a mathematical strategy called optimization. The initial version modeled a 100-acre farm planted with various combinations of 5 different crop types. On this virtual farm, raspberries, which use less water, proved to be more profitable than strawberries. The researchers have been checking with farmers to see whether their model offers reasonable results, and so far, the response is encouraging. They hope that their model will eventually help farmers all across the country, whether they are growing corn in Iowa or soybeans in South Carolina. In the Pajaro Valley, farmers are used to making changes. This area was once known for its apple orchards, but by the 1980s, berry and vegetable farming, which require more water than apple growing, had taken over, and the orchards were disappearing. Now, with continuing drought and salt water from the nearby ocean seeping into the ground, more changes may be in store. Page 37, Wild But True. Fungi turn ants into zombies. Imagine you're a carpenter ant just going about your business on the floor of the Brazilian rainforest. Suddenly, something hits you in the head. It's a fungal spore, a single-celled body capable of growing into a new organism. No big deal, you think, until you start to feel funny. And then you can't control your own actions anymore. You start walking like a zombie up a branch to a certain type of leaf. And when you get there, you bite down on the leaf and die. The fungus grows out of the top of your head and eventually shoots its own spores at passing ants. This real-life parasitic fungus, Ophiocordyceps unilateralensis, is known as the zombie fungus. Even though the fungus has no brain or nervous system itself, it still manages to control the insect it infects. A typical carpenter ant follows its colony's trail and searches for food before returning to the safety of its nest. An infected ant, on the other hand, wanders aimlessly before a death grip overtakes it. The fungal-controlled insect often climbs to the underside of a leaf that's 10 inches, 25 centimeters, above the forest floor. That's the height where the temperature and humidity are just right for the fungus to grow. Often the location is just above the ants' foraging trails, where its sister ants are moving. As the ants' fungal spores increase in number, they rain down on the ants below and zombify them. You're welcome. As of 2023, scientists have discovered 35 species of Ophiocordyceps that infect and zombify ants. but experts presume there are many more species yet to be found. Potentially thousands, they say. Enjoy your next picnic. I am going to skip how misperceptions and self-deception help raise the dead. Page 41, the afterlife of the solar system. What will happen when the sun goes down for good? In about 5 billion years, the sun will reach the end of its lifetime. That's far longer than the 4.5 billion years since the Earth became a planet. It's tens of thousands times longer than the period since humanity's ancestors first evolved, and almost a million times longer than the age of civilization. If the average human lifetime is 80 years, then more than 60 million human lifetimes will pass before the sun dies. Its final phases will bring chaos to the solar system, but in its afterlife, it will, for a time, set the stage for life to evolve in unexpected corners of the outer solar system. A typical star, the sun is already ancient, a full 4.5 billion years old, yet it's not even halfway through its life. Not until it is 10 billion years old, when it runs out of the hydrogen that fuels it, will it begin to transform. First, it will swell up into a red giant star, becoming simultaneously larger, cooler, and brighter. It will hover here for 100 million years or so before collapsing inwards. Another pause, this one up to a billion years as it burns through its helium. Finally, our sun will blow off its last layers, leaving behind a white dwarf roughly the size of Earth, though far more massive. As a white dwarf, the sun will no longer be powered by the fusion that makes it shine today. Lit only by the heat left over from its lifetime, it will slowly cool until eventually it winks out completely. When these changes arrive, they will have significant consequences for life in the solar system. Bad news for rocky worlds. The red giant sun will swallow up planets Mercury and Venus. Earth's fate is a bit more uncertain. As the sun grows outward, its changing mass will affect our planet's orbit. Those changes could push Earth far enough away that it skirts the edge of the enlarged star. Honestly, I'd have to place 50-50 odds on Earth making it, says Gregory Laughlin, an astronomer at Yale University. Even if our home planet survives, it won't be much fun to live on. Rising temperatures will set the oceans boiling and the steamy skies will heat the planet up even more. Mars will be a little luckier. It won't be consumed by a hungry star. The planet is not very welcoming to life on the surface today. Its thin atmosphere won't hold onto water and doesn't protect any visitors from dangerous solar radiation. When the sun becomes a red giant, temperatures on Mars will soar. It won't be a pleasant place to be by any stretch of the imagination, Laughlin says. 6 billion years from now, if humans haven't gone extinct, they will likely have left Earth behind. Where will they go? Moons of ice and smog. Scientists know life evolved on Earth, but they have a lot of questions about how it happened. Water is a primary ingredient, so most researchers searching for life focus on the habitable zone, a region around a star where liquid water could exist on the surface of a planet. Right now, Earth and its moon are the only significant objects inside the sun's roughly 55 million mile, 90 million kilometer wide habitable zone. But that won't always be the case. While the red giant sun will wreak havoc on the inner solar system, the environments among the giant planets will be far more hospitable. Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune are mostly made up of gas, and their structure won't shift significantly when the sun grows. But each of these planets has a wealth of moons. Those moons could find themselves suddenly ripe for life. The outer solar system would become more habitable, says Steve Desch. He is an astronomer at Arizona State University who studies icy worlds and exoplanets, or planets orbiting a star outside our solar system. The growing habitable zone will move outward. Eventually, its inner ring will move past these moons and all the way out to Uranus, its outer ring reaching even further. The moons will spend about 100 million years in the habitable zone before it passes them by and leaves them too hot to hold on to liquid water. But the sun won't be a stable red giant. Eventually, it will begin to shrink in size. The habitable zone will reverse course, moving back toward Saturn and its moons. Jupiter's moon, Europa, is already considered one of the most potentially hospitable spots in the solar system. An icy shell covers an ocean layer that may contain liquid water, giving this moon many of the ingredients thought necessary for life as we know it to evolve. It's possible that tiny bacteria are swimming around in Europa's hidden ocean today, and the growing sun would only improve this moon's chances at developing life, as rising temperatures melt the surface ice into the ocean. Europa doesn't currently have an atmosphere, but it's likely that a lot of that water would evaporate and create a steam atmosphere, says Desch. An atmosphere would keep the steam from escaping directly into space, so the ocean wouldn't completely boil away, and it would be pretty stable. Saturn's second largest moon, Titan, will also go through a dramatic change. Like Europa and Enceladus, Titan seems to be one of the best places to look for microbial life today. But if life evolved on the smoggy orange moon today, it wouldn't have followed the same path life took on Earth. Titan is the only place in the solar system with lakes, rain, and a thick atmosphere. But its most plentiful liquid isn't water. It's methane and ethane, organic carbon-rich liquids related to gasoline on Earth. That means if microbial life exists on Titan today, it could be significantly different from Earth's life. The sun's red giant stage will have a dramatic effect on Titan. Like many of the objects in the outer solar system, Titan has a mantle made of ice instead of rock. But rising temperatures will quickly change that. As the sun evolves, the ice will melt, said Carrie Anderson at a talk at the National Library of Congress. She's a planetary astronomer at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. I'm not sure if it will all melt, but a lot of it will melt, and you will have liquid water. Carbon-rich organic compounds, the building blocks of life, will mix with water to create an environment closer to what we see on Earth. For 100 million years, the conditions on Titan will be ripe to evolve Earth-like life. Eventually, the habitable zone will march on past Titan, and most of the water will boil away. Captured in the atmosphere, the water will work like a greenhouse to heat the surface of the moon even hotter. Once the sun contracts and the habitable zone slips back over Titan, this moon will have another chance to develop life. If the water in the atmosphere makes it too hot, the orange moon won't be very welcoming, but it's possible that things will stabilize on this moon. Maybe life has a real chance on Titan, Anderson said. Pluto and its neighbors. Pluto and its massive moon, Charon, lie at the very edge of the solar system, so far away that it took NASA's New Horizons probe 9 years to reach it. The spacecraft revealed a world rich in nitrogen ice with a heart-shaped plane on its surface. The dwarf planet is surrounded by Kuiper Belt, a collection of ice and rocks that swarm around the outskirts of the solar system. Right now on Pluto, the atmosphere is so thin you'd need a spacesuit. There are essentially no sounds to hear and nothing to smell, Desch says. You would see jumbled ice everywhere, but colored by the products of chemical reactions due to radiation. Rising temperatures could mean significant changes for Pluto and other Kuiper Belt objects, KBOs. Desch says that ice on the surface of the larger objects probably wouldn't melt until the sun reached its very hottest stages. The dwarf planets in the outer solar system should be able to hang on to their water vapor, but smaller objects wouldn't have enough gravity. They'd basically all be big comets, Desch says. Ice on Charon and the dwarf planets might melt, creating underground oceans. Adding water to any organic material hiding beneath their crust could create conditions for life. Some of Pluto's ice would jump to steam, thickening the planet's atmosphere, and winds would blow more fiercely. You'd probably see more weather, Desch says. Depending on what part of the sun's red giant stage we're talking about, you could even get snow, he says. The growing sun would dramatically change Pluto's sky. At the end days, the sun would be about 5 times wider in Pluto's sky than it looks like today from Earth's sky, Desch says it would be a very deep red, like an evil eye, out of fuel. After up to a billion years as a red giant, the sun will run out of helium, blow off the last of its layers, and collapse down into a white dwarf. Fusion will no longer power its heart, and its only energy will be leftover heat as the star gradually cools over billions of years. The remaining mass of the sun will be packed into an area about as small as the Earth. The habitable zone will no longer stretch out to the outer solar system. Moons and KBOs will ice over again. If a large enough planet is tugging at a smaller object, like a child pulling taffy, its interior may continue to remain warm. Conditions, though, will gradually become even colder than they are today. The sun's final habitable zone will be dangerously close to the star. Scientists have spotted other white dwarfs gobbling up their destroyed planets. But it's possible that a large enough object like Ceres, the only dwarf planet in the inner solar system, could create a haven for life. Like its fellow dwarf planet, Ceres hides an ocean beneath its icy crust. If you could get close enough to the newly shrunken star to take in its heat, but not close enough to be pulled in by its gravity, such an object could make the last stand for life to evolve or survive in the solar system. The sun's death will mean big changes for the solar system. If humanity has already left our planet to settle on others, we may be able to watch from afar as the solar system's hereafter gives other worlds a chance to host their own forms of life. I'm going to skip page 46 and move on to page 47, your tech. Is ghosting a good way to end a relationship? Your big brother has a social media streak going with his girlfriend close to 90 days straight. Then she drops it. She stops liking his image posts and replying to his DMs, direct messages. He texts her and gets no answer. It's as if she disappeared off the face of the earth and became a ghost. Ghosting is a silent rejection. It's a way of ending a relationship without going through the messy process of telling someone you want to break up. It's not new. People have always ignored one another as a way of sending a message. But now that social media and digital devices give us countless more ways to reach out to one another, we also have countless more ways to avoid one another. Ghosting has become a way to break up with someone. But is it a good idea? Ghosting may feel like the least messy way to handle a breakup. Jenny Molin is an American actress and writer who once ghosted a boyfriend she no longer wanted to see. She told the New York Times that she didn't know how else to end it. If you disappear completely, she said, you never have to deal with knowing someone is mad at you and being the bad guy. The person being ghosted, however, still feels anger and pain, plus confusion and frustration at the loss of contact. Some experts worry that people today are becoming less capable of handling difficult conversations. Social psychologist Sarah Conrath found that recent college students had fewer skills associated with empathy and emotional intelligence than young people in the 1970s. For example, today's teens are less likely to try to imagine a situation from another person's perspective. The reason may be simple, less practice. Digital communication is so easy that many people message, text, or email in place of engaging in face-to-face conversations. But these in-person talks have a lot to offer. Facial expressions, gestures, and tone of voice convey things that written messages and even emojis cannot. People gain a deeper understanding of one another when they talk face to face, and this is especially important when the topic is a hard one. Whenever I hear stories of romantic breakups, firings, or even arguments going on electronically, I cringe. Alex Lickerman, a physician in Chicago, wrote in Psychology Today, in-person interactions, though more difficult, are more likely to result in positive outcomes and provide opportunities for personal growth. Ghosting is the absence of interaction. Have you been ghosted? Have you ghosted someone else? Would you do it again? That completes the October edition of Muse Magazine. I'm Chris Radio Volunteer, Carla Pariser.